This is Bronson Fry with the Alaska Associated General Contractors Build Alaska podcast. I am honored to be joined today by Christian Muntean with Vantage Consulting. How are you doing today, Christian?
I'm doing real good. It's good to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. We had a nice time chatting a few weeks ago, and we brainstormed a little bit and had a subject here that I think is going to be really interesting to everybody listening that we wanted to dedicate an entire podcast to, and that is how to build not just a workforce, but a quality workforce. And I'll just kind of open it up to you, Christian, if you want to let us know what it is you do as your business in this world and how you might be able to help a construction company, and we'll just kind of go from there.
Yeah, so, I mean, broadly what I do is I help leaders grow their companies, whether grow them in terms of size or profitability or grow the value of their company. So that's largely what I do in a nutshell. Specifically in this space we were talking about, and this came from a lunch and learn that I did with AGC, I don't know, a number of months ago, but it was how to build a magnetic organization, an organization that can attract and retain ideal employees and not just regular employees. So that's part of what I do, is I help people think through how do you actually, part of growth, part of being an exceptional employer or having a great company is having great people. And so that's part of what I do.
Now, when you talk about ideal employees, what exactly does that mean?
Well, that's going to mean something different to, you know, every employer. But I'm pulling the thought from a Gallup study that was done that was looking at essentially, they didn't use the term, but it's essentially an application of the Pareto principle or the 80-20 rule, where they saw that roughly 20% of most workforces are responsible for about 80% of the productivity.
Interesting.
And so that's the idea, is that those 20% are really the ideal employees. These are the exceptional employees that are producing most of the results. And so ideally, you would want to attract and retain them, and ideally, you would want to attract and retain more of them than of the 80%. You would like to have half or all of your workforce be these ideal employees who are producing exceptional results.
Very interesting. So when it comes to building a quality workforce, it's not just attracting a larger percentage of the overall workforce. It's an actual exercise in attracting more of a specific segment of the workforce.
Absolutely, yeah. The studies are pretty clear on it, that most of the studies you read on how do you attract and retain employees are really targeted towards just the general whole group. Mm-hmm. So it's the average of that full 100%. But what motivates the 80% or the people who produce less on average is different than what motivates the ideal employees or the top 20%.
Okay.
And so if you really want to attract and then retain them, an employer has to act differently and has to respond differently, because that group of employees wants something different.
And what is it that motivates the bottom 80% versus the top 20% of producers in a workforce?
They're they're all motivated by similar things, but they order them differently is really what it comes down to.
Sure.
And
okay.
So the bottom 80%, they will often choose their jobs largely based off of compensation.
Okay.
And so that becomes the primary differentiator, is that if you pay a little bit better, 50 cents more an hour, a dollar more an hour, you can attract that person. Or if they think they can get more overtime or whatever it is.
Sure.
And people need those things, and I'm 100% supportive of paying really well and making sure that you're taking care of your people.
Right.
But the top performers, that's not what primarily motivates them. They want to be paid well. They want to be compensated for the value that they bring. But what they're really looking for is to work for great companies, companies that have great reputations, companies who act in alignment with their values, companies that accomplish really meaningful results. They want to work for great leaders, people who are inspiring, people that help them grow, people that help them accomplish more. They want to have a job that's interesting, that's fun. They don't want to be held back by bureaucracy or nonsense or pettiness on the job. They mm-hmm. want to be able to be free to really be good at what they do to the fullest extent that they can. After those things, they're interested in rewards. Mm-hmm. And even interesting, in the rewards category, being acknowledged for their contributions is often as much or even more of a motivator than actual pay. And again, this is not an argument against paying people. It's more of an argument that many employers really underestimate what motivates their employees. And it's often, for the best employees, pay is not, it's important. It's one of those things that has to be there, or you can't afford to work. But after you've been able to pay your bills and you can pay your mortgage and you can take a vacation and you can buy a couple of toys, people are looking for, where's the ideal place? And here's the thing, is these ideal employees, they know that they're ideal employees, most of them. They know that they're off. They know that they're kind of caring more than other people.
Sure.
And that might be a frustration that they feel, but because they know that they can choose where they want to go.
Right.
And so it's not that they're not loyal. They often will be far more loyal, but only at a place that they feel like is really the right place for them to invest themselves, because that's what's going to be what's motivational for them.
Right. Very interesting. So in a nutshell, the bottom 80% of producers in the workforce their biggest motivator is their pay or compensation, whereas the top 20% of the producers are motivated by culture, having a great company, great leadership, et cetera. And compensation is further down on the list, I imagine, in these studies.
They're all interested in the same things, but they rank them differently when you look at the studies. Yeah, and so culture is really the differentiator between companies that can attract or having a great – all companies have culture.
Right.
That just happens. But having a great culture – is what differentiates companies that are able to attract and retain these ideal employees.
Now, that's an interesting statement. You said all companies have a culture. Do you think it's possible that some companies have a culture that management or ownership is even unaware that their company has?
Oh, absolutely. I think most cultures are created by accident.
Okay. You know,
I think people are just in business. I'm a business person. People are just busy trying to get work done. They're trying to stay on top of things. They're trying to get contracts, you know, written. They're trying to get jobs done, make sure vendors are doing, they're busy doing this stuff, and they're not really paying attention to or being very thoughtful about or reflective about what's really important to me, because something is really important to me as a business owner, and then how do I act or behave in relationship to that, and how is that being expressed? And that combination of belief and values tied to the behaviors that come out of it is what creates culture.
Okay.
And so that always happens, but it mostly happens on accident. And so companies that are thoughtful about it, and some companies accidentally produce great cultures. It happens, but it doesn't happen a lot.
Sure.
It's usually a result of when companies decide to really be intentional about it, that they're able to create a larger culture. And especially as companies grow, it becomes very difficult to consistently just find management who automatically get the culture. And so you have to know, how do you train people to believe differently, to see life differently, and then how do you help them understand what are the behaviors that come out of that? So if you have to make this real practical, if you have a belief that the customer is valuable,
right,
and we want to treat customers well, and that's really a belief, not just something you say, then that's going to impact not only your return policies or your warranty policies or how you relate to people on a job site.
Sure.
It's also going to relate to how you hire people, because you're not going to hire people who you think are going to treat customers poorly.
Right.
You're not going to bid contracts in a way that you think is not respecting the customer in some way or is somehow going to be not favorable or beneficial to the customer.
Right.
You're
going to
relate differently all the way through your workforce and through your processes if that's a genuine value. And so it's knowing how to push that all the way through is part of this element of culture.
Well, I'm glad you said that, because it kind of leads right into my next question, which was, if beliefs and values create culture, then what sort of beliefs and values are we talking about in the world of business? You know, beliefs and values are go a broad spectrum, you know. So in this arena, when we're talking about labor management relations or running a business, What are some of the beliefs and values that you believe are important for a positive culture in a workplace?
Well, that's a great question. I typically will ask that question to the owners or the leaders of the teams that I'm working with to help them. I walk them through a process of clarifying what's really important to them. And one time I walked a group through a process, and the guy who hired me, his company is exploding right now. Like, it's multi-state and it's really become big since then. But when I first started working with him, I asked the leadership team he was with to be really honest, like, what are also the negative values? Like, the things that I'm not going to ask you to share with anyone.
Sure.
But what's something that's really important to you? You know, for example, like, is your sense of equity so important that revenge is important to you?
Okay.
Right? Because for some people, that's a driver. It's
fair,
a big deal.
Fair enough.
Right? You are not going to screw with me or I will get you.
Ah, interesting.
And so that's a value that drives a lot of their behavior. It's a deep thing.
In business, right?
In business and in life. It's
going to,
that value, wherever it's at, it's going to come out everywhere. And so I think mostly it's a question of paying attention to what your values are, and then aspirationally, as well as where you actually are at, what do you want your values to be in your company? And then being honest, is this something that's aspirational? In other words, I really wish we were more this way. I wish we were more customer focused, but truth be told, we're not, but we feel like we want to lean into that. So we're willing to make those changes. I find that owners, the more honest they are about their values, it helps. Now, if somebody said, something that nobody's ever said to me, but you just know it's true with some people. Let's say someone said, you know, revenge is a value to me.
Mm-hmm.
Revenge is a negative expression of a desire for justice.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right?
Sure.
So if I were to work with that person and they were to be as honest to say, I really want to get back at people or something like that.
Okay.
What I would do is I would see if they were willing to reframe that and say justice or fairness is really important to me. And if they are, then I would say that's probably your underlying value, is really to have a just workplace.
Right.
A workplace that treats people well. And I would try to reframe that with them positively. And most people aren't going to say I want revenge, most people go with that. And I try to find that positive reframing. And so I would say for most people, just thinking about whatever, being honest about what really drives me, what wakes me up and motivates me, what gets me emotionally energized positively or negatively, and what does that tell me about what's important to me?
Now, what I can't help but notice is that all of where we ended up is a lot of questions about myself inward looking questions.
So, absolutely. Yeah.
We started the conversation talking about beliefs and values in a workplace, how to create the culture of, quality culture. And it seemed like we ended up asking a lot of very personal questions about our own selves. So what does that, what broader concepts does that lead into with the message that that you have here?
If I understand your question right, I mean, I think what it really means is that if you're in a leadership or ownership position within a company, you really need to be willing to explore yourself. Because you are intentionally or unintentionally, you're the largest shaper of culture within your company. And so if what's happening right now and the common results that are happening within your company or experiences are not what you want, the leader has to be willing to ask, am I willing to change? Am I willing to do something different? And I have found that as a consultant to be something I ask now and I look at before I even get into a business relationship, because if the leader is not willing to do anything different, it's ridiculous to expect that you're going to get any other kind of results downstream. But if the leader is willing to say, I'll try, I'm not sure what that means, or I'm not sure what it'll take, or I'm not even sure if I'll like it, but I'm willing to try, then there's possibility. And definitely if they're gung-ho about it and ready to go, then it's almost guaranteed that they're going to get the results that they want. So absolutely, these things, to become an organization that can attract and retain the ideal employee requires building a culture that is attractive to that kind of employee who knows they have options, who can go where they want. And the way you build that, the simple version of the way you build that is as leaders, the leaders have to become the kind of people or begin to shift the way they relate, if it's not where they already are, to shape this new kind of culture and define that.
Right. So if 20% of the workers are producing 80% of the work, and the great employees know that they're great employees,
right,
then someone in a leadership or management position has to ask themselves, are they able to attract people out of that 20% into their company? And am I willing to change in order to do that?
Right. Yeah. So I recently published an article in Forbes, and I don't know if this is the best analogy or not, but oftentimes back when I was dating, people would score people and they would use the saying that an 8 is not going to go out with a 5 or a 4. And so if you're looking for 8, 9, or 10 level employees, and you're a 5 or a 4 or a 3 level employer, mm-hmm. you're not going to get, or at least not very often, are you going to get these 8, 9s, or 10s. Right. But you can choose to change and become an 8, 9, or 10 yourself, and then you sure. can attract them regularly right. and retain them.
And retain them, right. Yeah. It's indicative perhaps a little bit of a generational shift in the workforce also, and you and I talked a little bit before we started recording about there used to be, how there kind of used to be a dog-eat-dog culture that was viewed as like the normal business
right.
practice,
right.
Maybe the baby boomer generation.
Yep.
How has that changed in what you've seen in the way business is done?
Yeah, this is super important, and people have understood this in different ways, and the millennials, I think, get a bunch of unfair treatment by people on this. But basically what happens, baby boomers, I mean, they got the name because of just a huge amount of people, demographically, just tons and tons of people.
Right.
The generation, the World War II generation, above them, there was just far fewer people. So far fewer people means fewer organizations, fewer companies, fewer positions that you can get into. So you had an enormous population competing for fewer jobs and fewer organizations. So it's just high pressure on the system to try to get all these people in there. So that's one reason why the baby boomers are the highest entrepreneurial generation in America. Just tons of entrepreneurs came out of that generation. But it also meant that if you're trying to go through the existing structures that were in place, existing companies, very competitive. So you had all this fighting your way up the corporate ladder, dog-eat-dog stuff that you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
That came from that experience of there just wasn't as many positions as there were people.
Right.
That's totally different now. Now you have baby boomers who own, nationally they own over 50% of the businesses. In Alaska, baby boomers own 70% of the business, small, medium-sized businesses.
Wow.
They're owned by baby boomers.
Wow.
And so they're thinking about those experiences. They had those experiences, emotional experiences of fighting your way in, clawing your way to success. And they often will tell me, the people coming up behind me should be doing the same thing. I'm looking for someone who's got that same kind of fighting spirit, who's willing to kind of claw their way in. And they look for that, or I shouldn't just give this to someone. And I agree, I'm not a fan of entitlement perspectives or things can be handed off, but it's important to understand that for Gen X, who's the next generation coming up, people in their late 30s and 40s, early 50s now, that are coming up, and many of them are now running their own businesses and management as well, but for that generation, there's less people. And so particularly for your senior positions that you might be looking for, senior management, really skilled craftspeople or tradespeople, there's less of them. And they're looking at a space where there's lots of opportunity, lots of jobs out there. And both economically that's happening, but then also just because the baby boomers created a lot of jobs, now there's less people behind them. There's just fewer people. And so they don't have to compete. And if you're good at what you do, and you know you're good at what you do, I don't have to fight my way up your ladder. And why would I if you're not a great place to work?
Right.
And
you,
so,
right. You still need the culture anyway.
Yeah. So I'm going to go someplace else anyways, just because they're a greater, they're a better boss. They treat me better.
Very interesting. Yeah. Like you said, workers have good options. Well, especially good workers.
Good workers.
If,
yeah.
If you're in the 20% of those producing, you know, the majority of the work, you're going to have a lot more flexibility than maybe previous generations did.
Absolutely. In most fields, you can write your own ticket. I mean, you really can kind of call your own shots. If you have that confidence, you can pretty much do it because you're in demand.
So that kind of brings us right around to the construction industry. You know, most fields, I think you're right. You can punch your own ticket for the most part if you're one of those top 20% mm-hmm. workers. So what are some things that you might say to a small business owner in the construction industry that was, you know, interested in talking to you about their company? What are some things specific to that that you might be able to help with?
Well, I think if they want to try to really build this magnetic culture, I would encourage them to think about, just do an exercise of thinking about what's really important to them as owners. What are their values? What's their vision for their company? What are they trying to build? And get real clear about that. And then to think about what are the specific ways that people who believe those things and value those things relate. And so in terms of how you do your job, what does that look like in terms of how you relate to customers, how you relate to vendors, how you hire people? Every aspect of your company should stay in alignment with this vision that you're trying to build and your values. So this stuff feels very soft to people, and I think this is the challenge, is it feels soft, and it feels like this takes a lot of time, and right now I've got my phone ringing, and I got 1,000 emails I'm supposed to respond to, and I got stuff that needs to get done, and I don't have time for this. But what happens is it's kind of the concept of deferred leadership. If you don't step in and make this happen, you will pay for it down the road. And since a lot of my work is helping these baby boomers sell their businesses or drive the value up in their businesses so they can get more out of it when they sell, often many owners find that that's when they pay the cost of deferred leadership in a business that's worth almost nothing because they haven't done the things that they needed to do to really build a valuable business along the way. Well, or to build a brand or a culture, those kinds of things.
I really like that. I can promise you everyone listening to this podcast knows what deferred maintenance is construction.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So deferred leadership, I hadn't heard that before, but that's a pretty good turn of phrase.
Sure.
I like that. Now, it seems as though ultimately what you're driving at is that most good company success is due in some part to the character of the owner, the quality of the ownership, leadership, management, you know, whatever you want to call it.
Sustained success. You can get short-term success for a while.
Interesting. Okay.
And be an awful employer. I mean, it happens, right?
Sure.
But if over time, often people just realize they don't want to put up with it anymore. Or, and here's another reality. I mean, the world's not always fair. Life's not always fair. Things don't always shake out exactly fairly. But the... sometimes you're in a market where there's just you're the one person who has that set of tools or able to do that kind of job, and you get all the work and you're just making money hand over fist and you just don't have to care about anybody. And there's in Alaska, we've all seen people who are that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're able to do well, but they're never able to do as well as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a limit. And typically this deferred leadership concept comes in when they try to sell their companies, and then almost all of them are actually unable to sell their company is what you find.
Sure.
And it's just not worth anything and nobody wants it. And it's a huge shock to them because they were living large and now they got nothing.
Whoa.
And so it's a, anyways.
Well, it's a lot of interesting information that you presented here today. And I couldn't help but think as I sat here and chatted with you that in my role as a business representative of a building trades union, mm-hmm. I have a unique perspective on exactly what you're talking about when it comes to what motivates employees, because one of the things about a union worker is that their wages and benefits are all the same.
Right.
So I have a situation where I interact with union contractors and over time build a rapport and a relationship, get to know the kind of their character and the way their companies operate, their structure. And if it was simply money that motivated workers, nobody would ever move.
Right.
There would never be any shift in the organized union workforce at all. And yet, of course, that's not the case.
Right.
You do see companies that seem to have the best culture attract the best people.
Absolutely.
And even in examples where pay is identical.
Right.
And it just speaks to the truth of what you're saying about the value of culture in a company when it comes to attracting and retaining the best employees.
Yeah, and it's absolutely true, and it's one of those tough things that never shows up on a financial statement. It never shows up that you're paying for bad culture, that there's never like this depreciation cost in the value of your company because of bad management or because of treating people poorly or being vague about what you're about or inconsistent or any of those kinds of things. But you do pay for it. And it's a pretty dear cost, for that. The cost of employee turnover is one of the highest costs
sure.
that employers bear.
Training.
And the loss of training, all of those kinds of things, institutional knowledge, working with your team, that what it takes to get somebody onboarded and up
of
to speed.
Course.
The jobs that you don't pursue because you can't fill a crew.
Sure.
Or you don't have someone to manage or supervise it. All of those kinds of things are pretty high costs for employers.
Sure.
But you can ignore it. It's one of those really highly tolerated costs. But it's a great place for people that are willing to grow.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great way to start to set yourself apart from your competitors. And those same companies become attractive to vendors, they're attractive to the ones that are for other companies that are looking for partners. And it just becomes a great way to grow.
And the culture that you have as a quality place to work is going to reflect itself in the quality of your work in the construction industry, in the field.
Yeah, oftentimes,
and people
yeah.
are going to recognize that
yeah.
and desire that.
Yeah, and that's what attracts, you know, I was working with a company that, it was an engineering firm, and I was talking to a lot of the owners, because a lot of them went to work for that engineering firm, went to college, intending to hopefully someday work for that engineering firm. So they spent all of their time in college, did all of their work, tried to get internships, and spent years because they wanted to work for that company because it had such a strong reputation for doing cool projects and doing a really good job on those cool projects. And they wanted to be able to do that themselves.
Hmm.
And so that culture that company had was it just drew these ideal employees out of nothing. They didn't even have the skills when they themselves worked to be able to become an employee. And that's an ideal scenario for an employer where people are going out of their way that you don't even know yet because they want to work for you because they know that if you want to be the best at that trade, you got to work for these folks.
That's really, really cool. That's the way every company should hope to be.
Yeah, or at least the ones who do move in that direction, they're able to, you know, it gives them that unfair advantage.
Well, it makes sense to me to reach out to a company like yours, Vantage Consulting, and chat with you, Christian. I really appreciate your time. Would
yeah.
you like to let us know how folks can get a hold of you if they're so interested?
Yeah, they can reach me at christianmuntean.com. That's christianmuntean.com. And if you go to christianmuntean.com/culturechangeplan, I'll have a free resource that you can download right there that will walk you through some of the steps that I've talked about here.
Outstanding. I appreciate you letting us know where to go. That's christianmuntean.com/culturechangeplan. Thank you again for your time, Christian. Always
yeah.
a joy chatting with
yeah,
you.
Yeah, super good to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, have a great day.
Yeah, you too.
All right, thanks. Okay, ready. So, Christian, is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
Yeah, I'd like to offer a free resource if there's anyone who's interested in seeing how ready they are for an exit strategy or for selling their business. If they just go to christianmuntean.com/exit planning checklist,
mm-hmm.
They'll be able to download that there.
Outstanding. Give people a basic idea of how close they are to having their ducks in a row here for exit strategy.
Yep.
All right. Outstanding. Thanks so much.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you for listening to the Alaska Works Podcast, brought to you by a generous contribution from the Construction Industry Progress Fund and the Associated General Contractors of Alaska.